Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which are at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing great, doing great. I finished a book this week that I kind of wanted to recommend to you.
Okay.
The latest Stephen King novel. It's worth a look. Kind of a time travel story, the title of which is 11-22-63.
So he goes back. Whoever travels through time goes back in time to the Middle Ages.
11-22-63, Middle Ages.
I'm sorry. I was thinking 11-22. I didn't think about the 63. So they go way ahead in the future.
Actually, 11 would be the month, 22 is the date, and 63 is the year. So
I got you now. So they go to the day that Kennedy was assassinated is what you're telling me.
There you go. Exactly.
Okay, sorry. It took me 3 tries to get the most obvious thing in the world.
it's worth a look. It's not a perfect book, but what books are. I found it entertaining,
yeah.
and enjoyed it. And it's certainly a long book, and kept the pages turning. For if you sit down with a 1,000-page novel, and you rip through it in about 3 days, it's a good book.
So. Yeah, if you can. Well, Stephen King is always famous for that. Just writing those page-turning books, right? So it sounds
right.
Like he's still got it.
Yeah. Hey, there was a time when it seemed like his best days are behind him, I thought. Kind of right after that accident he had a few years back.
Right.
But he is, it seems like he's writing as well as he ever had now. And I'm grateful for that as a devoted reader of what he writes.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, what is he retired like 3 times, right? I mean, he's
well, that's the thing about being a writer. You can't, you're already at home, right?
I mean,
when you're
what's
a writer.
What's he going to do? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, where is he going to go to get away from the word processor? You can't get away from it. You can't get away from work. You're just there, so you might as well write something if that's the thing you know how to do. So I guess until he really starts fading, I imagine he'll continue doing it. So.
Yeah, well, and more power to him. He's definitely produced a lot of great entertainment over the years. Science fiction never his strong suit, but what you're describing isn't really a science fiction story per se.
No.
It sounds more like, time travel is the convention, but is it a horror story really, or just more of a suspense thing, or how would you classify it?
Not a horror at all, and no, not science fiction either. The mechanism by which the time travel takes place, I'm no spoilers here. It's not really a science fiction thing. It's just sort of, unless basically it's unexplained. Yeah, there's this doorway to the past, and there's never any explanation as to why it's there.
It's a fantasy story,
and,
in other words.
Yeah, it's just fantasy, and it's an interesting thing. You can go back in the past. You can change the past. The past has some resistance. The past doesn't like to change, but you can change it if you put up a fight. And then when you come back to the future, you can see what happened, what you changed, But if you ever go back again through that doorway, it's reset. And so, you know, that's sort of the...
So it's a very gimmicky kind of a time portal, you know?
Exactly. So yeah. If you go back and you do something that's just, oh, you just mess up the future bad, and when you get to Back to the Future, you realize it, you could just step back through the portal and reset it, and, you know, anyway. It's an interesting gimmick, and he mines it to full effect in this book, and it's definitely worth the read.
Well, I'm going to have to check that out for sure.
Yeah,
I don't know if I would have gotten around to it, but now that you've given it that recommendation, and now that I understand that confusing number, I think I'll...
yeah, I went out of my way to be confusing. I sure did.
Well, I couldn't hear the slashes. You know, all I could hear was...
Yeah, that's right. So that's right. Yeah. Exactly. I'm kidding, of course.
I understand. Okay. It's all right. I always have to take a certain amount of ribbing from the guy who can cut me off at any time, right? That's the thing. We know who wields the actual power on this show, so no problem at all. Hey, I've got a little before we jump in, just for folks in the chat room, for regular listeners, if you go to the top of the page for this week's show, and you go through the scroll, and obviously there's yours and my smiling faces, and the Fast Forward Radio logo, and then I just threw together this amazing logo, and I'm really thinking that maybe if I took it kind of shows the evolution of my mastery of computer graphics, really, when you come right down to it. If you look at the Fast Forward Radio logo, and then you look at the amazing logo. Because they're both kind of conveying, you know, some of the same sorts of ideas. So just an informal poll amongst the chat room. How would you feel if our new Fast Forward Radio logo was that amazing logo, but with instead of the word amazing, if it said Fast Forward Radio? I'll ask you, Stephen, first, and others in the chat room, if you'd like to chime in. How would you feel if we made that change?
Well, I'm going to tell you, the look of the galaxy is obviously much closer to being photorealistic. Is that an actual picture of a galaxy that you used?
That is a NASA photo of a galaxy. And in fact, if you go to the Speculus, that galaxy is our S in the Speculus. Now, one thing I would do is I would turn it so it makes an S. And that way we'd get the Speculus S into the Fast Forward Radio logo as well. Just brainstorming, just throwing out some ideas there.
I think
it looks better. Yeah.
Yeah, it does.
Okay.
A little more up to date.
We'll see what we'll see what folks in the chat room think. If that gets some positive feedback, I'll try trotting that out next week. I think I've already loaded the shows for like the next 6 months, and so I'm not sure I'm actually going to go through and change it week by week. Maybe I will, you know, depending on how good it looks. We'll see if I can be motivated to do that. So anyway, we got a big show tonight. We got a lot to talk about. And I originally was going to call this show Maximizing Serendipity. I'm drawing heavily on a bunch of blog posts I've done over at Transparency Revolution for a few of the topics that we're going to be touching on tonight. But some of the others are just things that I've found, mostly on Google Plus and Facebook. It's not hard to do something like gather topics for a show like this. I mean, it was never particularly hard for us. We've always enjoyed doing it. But do you remember when I used to do the Better All the Time roundups and I'd want to try to find 10 good news stories? And I would run
it
like every other week.
Yeah, sometimes it would be a little bit of a struggle. Sometimes we'd have to wait, you know, 3 or 4 weeks to get 10 good ones for the Better All the Time. Man, you can do 10 good ones a day now.
It could be like Toronto's Best of the Web Today, right? We could do a Better All the Time today, every day. And it would be at least 10. So what you get from us when we do one of these shows, you know, every few weeks is just kind of the best of the best, right? The ones that really caught our attention during that week, because there's just so much cool stuff to be talked about. But I did this post on Transparency Revolution, and Glenn Reynolds picked it up, so it garnered some additional discussion over and above what you'd normally see for a Transparency Revolution post, and the title of it was Amazing Things. And I don't know if you saw that one, but basically it was just a picture I lifted right off Facebook. Here's the caption: Autistic artist Stephen Wiltshire draws spellbinding 18-foot picture of New York from memory after a 20-minute helicopter ride over city. And The picture's over at transparencyrevolution.com, so if you haven't seen it yet, go check it out. It is just absolutely unbelievable. Obviously, the man is an extremely gifted artist, but what astounds me is, you know, he gets up in a helicopter, he looks at Manhattan for 20 minutes, and the detail to which he is able to reproduce this thing is just, it's mind-boggling. Have you ever seen anything quite like that?
Well, yeah, and it's always associated with people that have that sort of, gift / curse, you know, or whatever you want to call it. That man's mind works differently from most people. Does.
Yeah.
I think that's safe to say. And it says autistic. Okay, that's what's going on with him. He's autistic. And I think that's a big part of what autism is that, for example, you and I, you know, as babies, Phil, I mean, you would be attracted to the face of your mother. You would look at your mother, and that's what you would, you know, if your eyes wandered the room and you saw your mother, that's what you would look at, right?
Right.
You look at other people's faces were more interesting than, say, the leg of the couch or whatever. That's not true with autistic people. Autistic people, everything in the room is equally interesting, and they focus on everything. And so people are, you know, this is my understanding of what autism is that people are less interesting. And so that's why autistic people a lot of times have trouble with social interaction. That's that's just the dime store version. I'm sure I'm oversimplifying in many ways, but that's my understanding.
Well,
and that
I think you make some really good points. One thing you have to keep in mind. Here's the thing that's really interesting. Not every autistic person is a savant.
Right.
But it seems to go with it sometimes, and sometimes you see these incredible abilities and. They just seem all that much more magnified because, yeah, here's an individual probably does have an awful lot of trouble with social interaction, probably has a lot of trouble with day-to-day things that we completely take for granted, and yet he's able to do this magnificent thing. But the other side of that is the side that I was thinking about when I wrote the post, because what I wrote was, human beings are capable of amazing things. Don't make excuses. Do something amazing. Just kind of, you know, your typical greeting card kind of sentiment, right?
Right.
Not all autistics are savants,
right?
All savants are autistic, either. You know, there are some people who have incredible mathematical abilities and who can still interact socially, right? I think to your point, what often happens is the filters and the infrastructure that we develop neurologically. To deal with things like, you know, basic social interaction, basic day-to-day things that we have to do, they crowd out like some innate abilities that are probably sitting there in, I don't know if they're sitting there in everybody's brain, but potentially are sitting there in a lot more brains than people realize. There are probably a lot of people out there who could do something like this and who've never even tried, right? Who have no idea that they have that kind of capability or something equally amazing, or you know what, something even way less amazing, but still amazing because it's an ability that you had that you didn't realize was there. And in fact, we're going to come back to this whole idea of getting stuff out of the way of the brain for one of our later topics. But I thought it was really interesting because I put this up and immediately got a comment from a reader who wrote, "I cleaned, did laundry, paid bills, went to my tailor, and went to Target." Where I bought toilet paper. Can I do something amazing tomorrow? I'm beat. Oh, who exactly is the amazing judge? Are they easily impressed? Do they sneer at things? Misspelled sneer, by the way. Do they sneer at things that are just okay, cool, or reductive, in quotes? Can I crush them with a rock? So,
oh, man.
You know, so
taking
I tried
offense,
to...
somehow you managed to offend somebody slightly with this post, which would be the essence of non-offensive, if you ask me.
Yeah.
Anything?
You know, one thing I need to make very clear, and I'll try to make this clear from now on in all blog posts and in all advice I give on this program. When I say something like do something amazing, it's purely optional, folks. Okay, no requirement.
You're free to be mediocre.
Yeah, I am not going to be checking up on you later. You know, enjoy your life, be happy. But the cool thing was, just like a few minutes after I read that comment, I go back on Facebook and I find the second picture that I posted, which is just this wonderful image. It's a little boy.
I love this. I love this.
Yeah. Apparently, I would guess a double amputee. I'm not sure. He could have had a birth defect and not had legs. I'm not sure. But he's got, I don't know how much of his legs are missing, but definitely from about the knee on down, he has no legs. He has no feet. He's wearing the number. He's on a track. He's obviously participating in some kind of Special Olympics event, which is great. I mean, he just looks totally cool. But it's the look on his face, right?
Oh, yeah. It's beautiful. It's beautiful. This kid's
just
happy.
Yeah.
He is competing and having a good time.
Exactly. Just this unbridled joy on this kid's face. He's having a great time. He's doing exactly what a kid wants to do. And the fact that he doesn't have legs doesn't even enter into it. And
no.
I did not add the text that is written across that picture. It was there already. And the single line is much, much nastier than I ever get with people. It just says right out, your excuse is invalid. So, you know, anybody that doesn't want to be amazing, it's okay with me, but just look at that kid and then don't try to do anything with your life. That's all I have to say. Okay?
It's the dodgeball thing all over again, you know.
That's right. That's exactly.
What are you dying of that would keep you from doing this?
Yeah,
right now,
it ought to feel like
shame
at that.
Oh, gosh. I love it.
That's go ahead.
Now, I was just going to say, a lot of times we don't know what our talents are, even until, you know, later in life. You know, I mean, there's always more to discover about yourself. It's, there's a famous artist that didn't even get started until she was like 70. What was her? It was Grandma Moses or
Grandma
something
Moses,
like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
And, how old was Colonel Sanders when he started his restaurant business?
Like
I mean,
in his 60s.
Yeah. And so, I mean, and I'm just giving a personal example. Cheryl will probably kill me, but I'm going to go ahead and tell it. She has discovered about herself that she can do amazing pencil sketches of children's faces. I've never seen anything like it. I mean, it's like, if I were to try to draw somebody's face, Phil, I've tried, you know. It looks ridiculous. It looks like a stick figure. It's not, you know, that is not my talent. But when she sits down, she captures the character of people with just a pen and paper, pencil and paper. And
that is
something she just discovered about herself in the last couple of years. And here we are, you know, entering our 40s. So
Sherilyn. You mean you. You meant to say you're.
Yeah,
name,
yeah,
so
yeah.
She's
yeah, we were born in the same year, but she's about 10 years younger than me now somehow. I don't know how that happened.
I tried to give look. You know what, dude? I tried to give you an out there. Okay, I tried. I did my best.
Hopefully, this is not one of the ones that she'll sit and listen to. She listens to a lot of these shows.
Yeah.
Anyway,
steer her away from this one for sure. But that is remarkable. That is remarkable. Because if someone is inclined to do something, and it's exactly my point. If someone's inclined to do something like that, they usually figure it out. You know, when they're 8, 9 years old, probably, right? It starts
right,
showing.
Right.
But not.
Well, for whatever reason, I mean, she was like, doing other things. She was, and this just, she just kind of found this out about herself. And so you can, it's interesting. There are talents that you have that you do not know about. And, sometimes it's worth trying things just to discover new things you can do. So.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yep. Well, and that sort of goes to my whole idea here about maximizable serendipity. I'm just going to go ahead, I think, and read this quote. I thought this was so cool. This is from Nassim Nicholas Taleb, who wrote The Black Swan. And prior to that, he wrote Fooled by Randomness, which is one of my all-time favorite books, just a fantastic book about how little we understand how major a force randomness is in driving everything in our lives. But in The Black Swan, he kind of turns that around a little bit because he talks about the fact that, yes, things happen randomly, but one thing that predictably will happen randomly is this huge outlying thing that you don't expect to happen. And, in fact, there are a lot of smaller outlying things that you don't expect to happen. And he gives this advice. He says, maximize the serendipity around you. Many people do not realize that they're getting a lucky break in life when they get it. If a big publisher or a big art dealer or a movie executive or a hotshot banker or a big thinker suggests an appointment, cancel anything you have planned. You may never see such a window open up again. I'm sometimes shocked at how little people realize that these opportunities do not grow on trees. Collect as many free non-lottery tickets, those with open-ended payoffs, as you can. Once they start paying off, do not discard them. Work hard, not in grunt work, but in chasing such opportunities and maximizing exposure to them. This makes living in big cities invaluable because you increase the odds of serendipitous encounters. You gain exposure to the envelope of serendipity. Well, I love the quote, but I actually will take the advice even a little bit further. I think that that this advice applies far beyond having meetings with big, important art producers or you know, art gallery owners or movie producers or big thinkers. Although you and I have the opportunity to have those from time to time, and I think we've capitalized them on those quite well. And I think it goes beyond living in a big city too, because I think we live in an age of maximizable serendipity simply because of how connected the world is and because of the other thing we always talk about on the show, how fast things are changing. There is so much more occurring. There are so many more people that you're connected to through social networks and through email and through the people you're connected to. It's like every time you're connected to one new person, you're connected to everyone that person knows indirectly, right? It's the fantastic thing about social networks. So when you start combining those two things, when you combine this like really hard to imagine number of people that we're all connected to and the rapid pace at which new things are happening, particularly good things, as we were just talking about, the kind of blinding pace of good news, I think that there is a scope of possibility. I think that we have a wealth of possibility, a wealth of non-lottery tickets that we can cash in that's just completely unprecedented in human history. We have to go out and look for it. It was great. I put that post up I think it might have been Google Plus, might have been Facebook, I'm not sure. And Chris Hall responded because all I wrote was maximize serendipity, and he wrote back, "Well, that takes a lot of hard work." And yeah, it would. I mean, it you know, to create coincidences, you know, to create unexpected major chance things happening, would take a lot of work. But actually, what it takes a lot of is a lot of paying attention and a lot of creatively assessing our circumstances, looking at our circumstances differently than we've looked at them before, and starting to see the fact that there's so much happening and there's so many opportunities, you know, it's really about getting your hands on one or two of them and going someplace with it.
You know, this idea that living in big cities is invaluable because it increases your chances of serendipity, I would suggest to anyone that you can, in effect, increase the size of your city. And I'm not just talking about, you know, through social networks or on the internet or something like that, but let's just say, you know, if you're living in New York and you spend every evening in front of the TV set, you might as well be living, you know,
in Paducah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But if you're living in a small town and you're out and involved in your community and you know, you're every night you got something different going on and you're always meeting new people and you know, it's as though you live in the biggest city ever, you know? I mean, that's there's one thing to be said, like, for example, like going to college at a smaller college, you know, you'd think, well, does that limit your, you know, the chances of meeting people? Actually, you know, if you're going to a college that might have 2,000 or 3,000 people, there's a fair chance you get to know pretty much everybody, whereas you might not know that many people if you go to a school of 100,000, you know, I mean, you might get to know 5 or 6 people.
Exactly. It's what you do with these connections. And I think, right. I think you make a really good point because the person who can open up a whole new world for you might not be a big thinker, big writer or producer or, you know, art gallery owner or whatever. It might be someone who's relatively an unknown person, but who has an idea that turns into something huge in your life. So, I don't mean to minimize the fact that, yeah, there are big influencers in this world, and sometimes it is important to try to connect with someone who has made a name for themselves. I don't mean to suggest that that's not an important thing to do, but it's not the only important thing to do. I guess that's my point. That
yeah.
there are
that's
there
fair.
Can be equally important connections to make with people who no one would ever guess, you know, are the are going to be the big movers and shakers in your life. So yeah, I think we live in this age of maximizable serendipity, and a big piece of it is just recognizing how rapidly things are changing, recognizing the incredible improvement that's taking place, and getting yourself in the middle of it, you know, making yourself part of that process, and making some cool stuff happen.
Absolutely. I'm looking here in the chat room. Jab says, "Friends of friends connections on Facebook is on average just over 100,000 people."
Wow.
Because if a friend of a friend posts on your page, you know, their friends see it too. That's interesting. But yeah,
that is a big audience, isn't it? I mean, that's a lot of people. That's a big city right there. I mean, it's a fair-sized city anyway.
Yeah.
And if something goes viral, if they start spreading it to their friends, and so on, who knows?
Absolutely.
Very interesting. So for the rest of the program this evening, we're going to be looking at some of these rapidly changing things that are happening in our world. And I just grabbed a bunch of them as I mentioned. But we'll start with this one because it encapsulates the whole serendipity thing. It encapsulates the whole do something amazing thing. I'm sure you saw this headline: 10-year-old discovers new molecule.
Yeah. I love that.
what more? You know, it's like, okay, good night, everybody. You know,
we're done.
Point made.
Well,
okay?
You know what's interesting about this is that it was the way it was done. This science teacher, he's got a fifth grade science class. He has what in effect amounts to what looks a little bit like Tinker Toys, right? And the different connections will only fit together in a certain way, so as to emulate how certain atoms only fit together in certain ways to make molecules.
Right.
Well, and so this kid's playing around with how these different things fit together, and you know it doesn't fit together in some ways, and other ways it does. He comes up with something that looked interesting to him, and he brings it to the teacher and says, "What's this?" And the teacher basically says, "This looks interesting. I don't know what it is."
Yeah, I mean, the question was, is this really a molecule? It kind of the pieces fit. I mean, I think it was a girl, actually.
Was it a girl? Okay. All right.
Yeah, she followed the rules and came up with a configuration that wasn't on the list, right? If you follow the rules, you can make this molecule. Is this one? And he looks at it and he goes, "I don't know if that's a molecule or not." And sends it to a colleague who takes a look at it and recognizes that, you know, it is a molecule that has never been synthesized before. So it's actually a compound that already was known and already exists, but in a different molecular form than had ever been posited before. So this isn't the discovery of a new compound, but it is absolutely the discovery of a new molecule. So the scientist that the teacher sent the picture to writes a paper explaining this new – a scientific paper explaining this new molecule out to the – you know, peer-reviewed paper out to the scientific community. And listed as a co-author is this 10-year-old fifth-grade child who has now made this rather significant contribution to science. I'm going to throw the link into the chat room because I just realized that the link I put up on both sites was not correct. Here's the actual link, folks, if you want to check this story out.
And what this molecule was apparently was it was like nitroglycerin but different. And so apparently it could be used as an energy storage molecule, or perhaps could even be an explosive. You know,
yeah.
that, uh, so That's pretty cool.
Tetranitroxycarbon. Tetranitroxycarbon. kind of a mouthful. And if you follow the link and you look at the picture, a pretty complicated looking molecule. So this was this was a non-obvious thing. What's interesting about this is this kid who did this, you know, we don't know what was going on in her head as she's putting these things together. And it's, if you read the story, there's a lot of skepticism as to whether there's anything at all in this story. You know, a lot of people going, so what? She put Tinker Toys together and coincidentally hit a molecule. I'm sorry, I don't, you know, I'm like, those Tinker Toys have been available to scientists forever, right?
And right.
None of them have come up with this, so.
Not that one. And,
you know,
and she just followed the rules. She was told here's how, you know, these only work together to fit together in this way and that way, and so she did it and here you are. So I do not dismiss that at all. It's what she was able to come up with by playing with what amounted to kind of fancy Tinker Toys is pretty awesome, and it's a real contribution. So yeah, don't take anything away from this.
I certainly wouldn't. What she did was she engaged that possibility space in a creative way and came up with something new for the whole world. And I think it's I think it's quite remarkable. It's a great example of somebody doing something amazing, and it's a great example of achievable serendipity, the kind of serendipity that's lying out there waiting for us to just come and get it, basically. So. Fantastic for her. Now she's, according to the story, showing a greater interest now in biology, and who knows, might go on to become a scientist and make other important discoveries, you know, even when she's 12, 13, 14 years old. Who knows? She's, you know, she's still got a lot of good years left in her, so we're hoping to see big things from this kid going forward. Anyway, I thought that was a great story and a good example kind of everything we're talking about. Now, this next one is really just related to some of our more fun geek stuff. Have you read up on transparent iron?
Yes, I have. I found that very interesting. I'm reminded, of course, of the Star Trek
transparent aluminum.
Yes, of course. But
which we have discussed probably at greater detail than we should have on this program.
Whenever we get to talking about Star Trek things, we probably spend more time on it than we need to. But anyway, this is interesting stuff here. This transparent iron that's not really transparent, it sort of has a mirroring thing going on that makes it seem transparent, but not. They say that one of the interesting things about this thing is that it could be used as a controlled light switch or an optically controlled switch that could be an important part of building an efficient quantum computer. So.
Uh-huh.
Interesting things. You're probably, when they set out to play around with these things, I wonder if it was, you know, if the thought even occurred to any of them. This might be useful in a quantum computer, or if they were just messing around and just doing pure science, and then somebody else thinks of perhaps an application after it's done. That's often the way it goes. So
we should probably clarify that when we say it's transparent. Per your comments, we're not talking about in a gross, everyday optical sense, right?
Yeah.
It's not like you could have a sheet of this iron, hold it in front of your face, and see through it. Or is it?
No, I don't think so.
No.
It's not like that at all. And it's also very thin. We're talking just atoms thick. But it's
transparent to the extent that, as you said, you could use it in a quantum computer because it's not going to impede the flow of, I guess it would be photons, that would be in the same way that glass wouldn't impede or some of the transparent, you know.
Well, it doesn't impede it when you don't want it to impede it. In other words, it could easily be used as a switch to impede when you want it to and then to let it go pass through when you want it to. I think that's
right.
The idea here. It's cool. Very, very neat.
It's a really interesting discovery. We keep hearing these little breakthroughs related to quantum computing, and eventually these are going to add up to something huge. I don't even pretend to know what it's going to be, but I think we're going to see something really major occurring with quantum computing over the next few years, and it's going to be probably the synthesis of several of these ideas, because every now and then we'll hear something that's like, oh, and here's another breakthrough that is probably going to be helpful in realizing the potential of quantum computers. It seems like that's one of those things we hear every, what, quarter, every 6 months, something like that. Something big comes along that's pushing us in that direction. And there's a lot of interesting stuff potentially that can be done with a quantum computer. So any development that pushes us in that direction is definitely something to keep an eye on.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Can I throw out one that's not on your list?
Well, yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Israel could be the third nation to put a probe on the moon, and this time it won't be a government program. It's three scientists in their spare time attempting to win a Google X Prize of putting a probe on the moon. They would win $20 million if they're able to do so, and their idea is that they're going to repurpose some technology that is everyday technology. They won't say what. I'm getting the feeling it's a smartphone on wheels. That, you know, they're talking about something as small as a Coke can that they're going to put on the moon and, you know, be able to roll it around and look around a little bit and transmit video and signal back to Earth. They're Israeli scientists. So they're saying if we're able to do this, Israel will be only the third nation to manage to get a probe, an operating probe, put on the moon. So it's, you know, and these guys are doing it. This is not, you know, again, not a government program. These are scientists. They teach. They do, you know, they do experiments. And this is almost kind of in their spare time kind of thing, doing what, you know, in the past it's taken nations to do with huge programs, you know, billion-dollar programs. These guys are going to put something together, and it's going to be expensive. They've had to get, you know, raise the money. It's somewhere in the neighborhood of $10 to $15 million
to enter. You know, it's not cheap to enter. $50,000 to enter. And this, we should mention, this is the Google Lunar X Prize. So there's $20 million at stake for whoever makes this happen.
Right. And they are the ones who are going to launch first, or at least are scheduled to launch first. There are other competitors in the Google X Prize, but they're not going to be able to lift off until next year at the earliest. These guys intend to do it this year, late 2012. So
it's an amazing story. I'm glad you brought it up. I thought I had it on the list. I actually intended to have this on the list for tonight. So we're talking about it anyway. That's awesome.
Serendipitous.
It's quite serendipitous that you would mention it. Now the Google Lunar X Prize is, we should say, you got to get something there. You don't have to get it back, right? That would be.
You do not have to get it back. That would be too. That would be. It'd be a difficult thing to get it home. And so they, you know, whoever's donating their smartphone to the cause, if that's what this thing is, is not going to get their smartphone back. Yeah, I'm sorry. You've lost it.
Yeah. Well, not for some years anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
At best. Yeah. It probably won't be worth as much by the time somebody's able to get back there and retrieve it. But it would be a bigger prize. It would probably be a $100 million prize or more if we were talking about sending something to the moon and bringing it back. But just getting something to the moon is it actually going to land on the moon?
Oh yeah, it'll land on the moon and roll around on the moon. It's a little mobile probe that will, you know, land on the moon, roll around the moon, and transmit video back home.
And that is something only
the Soviet Union and the United States has done. Russia hadn't even done it since they've been Russia. You know, it was back when they were the Soviet Union. So
they were the Soviet Union. They were sending craft to the moon. And I know that they had a probe in the 60s that was to land on the moon, gather samples, and come back, an automated probe similar to our Viking spacecraft that went to Mars, only with the capability of coming back. And they had one of those scheduled to just barely beat Apollo 11 to the moon. It crashed into the moon, so the thing didn't work out. But what they had done prior to that, and what we had done prior to that, was we had landed something on the moon. And that is no small task, as we both know from reading this book, Rocket Men, which we're going to have to do a show about at some point. Just actually landing an object on the moon is a fairly tricky set of calculations that you have to go through. There's a lot that can go wrong. You can end up on a rock. You can end up in a crater. You can end up smashing into the moon faster than you intended to. It's not like you can parachute down. There's no air. So it's a matter of
thrusters.
This controlled fall all the way down. Neil Armstrong did it brilliantly with Apollo 11. But that's having a person there in real time doing it, not something you're able to do when you're sending a probe out. That's going to be delayed if you're using instruments and controlling it that way. So chances are you have to have the smarts built right in to make that work. Which is a fairly daunting challenge, I would think. I wonder how much there's, the story doesn't say, but I wonder how much they're spending on this altogether.
I got the idea from the Forbes article that it's north of $10 million. It's going to be an expensive thing to do, but they've got all kinds of sponsors. A lot of people are really excited in Israel, particularly, are really excited about these are Israeli scientists doing this, and it's going to inspire young people in Israel to enter sciences even more. It's funny how I read that article and it's as if they're saying we just don't have enough of our people in sciences, but Israel is for the size of the country it is, it's remarkable what they what they do and what they contribute in sciences, but they feel they can do more, and this would be something to inspire young people, particularly in Israel, to get involved, and so that's really cool. I wanted to throw out, this is completely unrelated, but it's kind of a moon story. Apollo 10, that was the dress rehearsal for Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin's landing on the moon.
Yep.
Just an interesting thing, they did not put fuel in the lunar lander. They did everything exactly like that they were going to land on the moon. It was it was just to be an orbital flight. Do you know why?
Let's see. Would that have been to keep them from actually giving it a shot? Probably.
Exactly. Yeah. They put the same amount of weight in the ship as if they had fueled the thing up. But according to Gene Kernan, who was the head of the program, he says, "Do not put fuel in that thing. Those dudes will land."
Right, right. They'll beat Apollo 11 to the punch. That's hilarious. Well, now did they actually separate the two and do the docking and practice all that, or
they did it all? It was a complete. They did the docking and everything, just as if they were.
Yeah, when they separated, if there'd been fuel in the LEM, they could.
We might as well go.
It.
Yeah, why don't we come down and take a look down around here?
We've come all this way. Yeah,
we might as well. It's right there.
Skim the surface.
Yeah,
but they didn't put the,
that was from Rocket Man.
And so those guys knew there was no fuel in there to enable them to do that.
Exactly.
That really
so
bad not to tell them.
Yeah, psych. No, they told them, guys, you have no fuel. That's you've got sand in the gas tank. To simulate the weight. But you do not have fuel to go down. But anyway, I thought that was just an interesting Apollo story. There's a million interesting Apollo stories, and getting through Rocket Man I am having a time finishing that book because there's a million of these little anecdotes that I have to just stop and laugh about instead of just reading straight through. But anyway, that's a great book.
Yeah, absolutely. I can't recommend that book highly enough to anyone who doesn't know much about our first moon landing, or anyone who thinks they know a lot about it. It's a completely fresh perspective on the whole thing, and it's just a terrific bit of history. Great piece of writing, actually. Really, really draws you into all aspects of it and makes it come alive. And you learn. I personally learned quite a bit, and thought I was pretty familiar with the history anyway. It's great stuff. Hey, speaking of the moon, which is becoming one of our favorite topics, and we're going to come back. We're going to do another show about moon colonization. We are going to follow up on our show last week because I don't think we got nearly as deep into that as we would have liked. I've actually sent some follow-up questions to our guests from last week, and we'll be dealing with those on the air. But did you see the story? Moon draws growing interest as a potential source of rare minerals. This is falling into what you see here now falling into place is more and more rationale, business reasons, commercial reasons, what Rand was talking about last week, you know, like solid economic reasons for going to the moon. And one of the good reasons for doing this is the fact that there's stuff up there that we don't have a lot of down here, or that you know, we have almost none of down here, and they list them in this article, things like gadolinium, terbium. These are important minerals. These are things that are used in TVs. They're used in hybrid car batteries. They're things that are increasingly part of our world, but we don't have much of them on our world. But there's quite a bit of them up on the moon. When you start cutting the costs of getting there, and when you start talking in realistic terms about either being able to send a machine there that could pick stuff up and bring them back, or actually having the infrastructure in place for people to live on the moon, to work on the moon, this would be one of the industries that would support permanent residence on the moon. Mining is something that has been talked about in science fiction and has been speculated about for years, but we understand the moon well enough now, the composition of it and just generally what's up there, that we have a much better idea of not only how we could build a permanent settlement up there. Brian was talking about the fact that there's plenty of water up there, which wasn't known in the past, but also what, you know, specifically what we'd be doing. I mean, when I was a kid, they used to speculate, well, maybe there's diamonds up there, right? We could find diamonds on the moon. We could have diamond mines. And I'm not sure there's not. I'm not saying that there aren't diamonds on there, but it turns out that there's things potentially much more valuable than diamonds in the forms of some of these minerals. And, of course, we've talked about thorium. We've talked about helium-3. There's potential great energy sources on the moon. There's other industries that the moon could support as we went into last week. But I just thought that was really interesting that this story pops up this week just as we're having this conversation about the economics of going to the moon. So it would not be surprising at all as a permanent presence on the moon becomes more likely, some very industrious individual or company, some far-thinking company, starts getting serious about getting up there to get some of the wealth that's up there and take advantage of that.
You know, it would be kind of an interesting thing. You know, China is in control of a lot of the Earth's supply of these minerals, these rare earth minerals. And, you know, they had a brief embargo here just a few months ago, right?
Yep.
They just decided, hey, you know, we're going to throw our weight around a little bit and just let you know, like OPEC used to do to us, that you know, we're kind of in charge here, and we're going to kind of set the price, and so we're just not going to ship these rare earth minerals at all right now. What if an embargo like that were to actually be the thing that gets us to the moon? You know, all of a sudden those minerals become much more valuable to us because we can't get our hands on the Earth supply, so let's go to the moon.
Exactly.
You say, just interesting. What we know is up there, and you know, if there are valuable things that we already know, there's going to be a lot there that is going to be valuable that we don't know about yet. So, maybe we just need to get back there. What do you say?
I think let's go. Actually, that one of the questions for our panel last week that we didn't get to was, would you go?
Go or not?
And,
go or not
when,
go? Yeah.
When we come back to this, Stephen, you and I can talk about, would we go to the moon? Would you go live on Mars? Would you go live in an orbital space station? There might be different answers to each of those questions, or you might have the
yeah.
same
okay,
monosyllabic
so
answer to each of them. But we'll
so
get into
you,
that.
Your vote is go. My vote is go. So we choose to go to the moon. Okay.
We choose to go to the moon. Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know what? We need to pause here just for a moment and say hello to Lisa, who's listening this evening, Paul Vasquez's mother. Welcome to Fast Forward Radio. We're so pleased to have you listening this evening. All right.
Absolutely. And she was awakened to see men walk on the moon the first time. She was mentioning her memory of that. That's awesome. I was not born soon enough to or to see that. So, the rest of us get, you know. Bill, you remember it, don't you?
I do remember it, absolutely. I remember sitting with the family and watching it, and as they describe in the book Rocketman, the image was so high contrast when it first showed up on the screen in Houston, and that's exactly what we saw when it first showed up on the screens in our homes. And it took me a few minutes to actually be able to put the picture. It looked to me like I was looking at visual gibberish as Armstrong is coming down the thing. And finally it resolved and it cleared up, and it's like, oh, there's a man. Here he is. He's coming. And you see it. And yes, it's seared in my memory. Absolutely. One of my most distinct childhood memories actually is sitting with my family and watching the Apollo 11 landing. Great, great moment.
Yeah. I'll bet. All right. Well, all right. What's our next topic?
Well, you know, we've got. I'm looking at the time here. We've got so many to choose from, and I'm trying to be judicious. I think what we should probably do with the time we have remaining, we'll probably not get into business being good this evening with so little time. So let's spend a little bit of time talking about this. Zap your brain into the zone, because this actually swings back around to our discussion at the beginning around people having access to different parts of their brain, people being able to use their brains differently. Now, I don't know if you had a chance to read this, but this is talking about this idea of flow. Well, once again, I seem to have messed up the link. I apologize for the links, everybody. I'm trying to follow my own links. I'm not getting to these stories, so it must be frustrating for people listening along, because they don't have them sitting here in a notepad document, which I actually do. I just have to find it. But this is in NewScientist.com. Zap your brain into the zone, fast track to pure focus. This idea of athletes, they also use the example of soldiers in combat, people who are involved in highly intense work that really requires unbelievable focus, achieve this state that they refer to as flow. It's this idea that you're...
I'm in the zone. I've heard athletes say I'm in the zone, or you know, someone describe a situation where someone is playing just incredibly well. They're being in the zone. So yeah.
Absolutely, and you know, one of the ways that people achieve this, because I think it's actually a pretty addictive experience. I think that people are drawn to things that will put them into this state. Gamers experience this as well, and in fact, the story starts out.
I experience it finding these stories.
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah,
seriously. Yeah.
Same here. Doing this show, actually, once in a while we kind of get into that. It's just actually more often than not, I would say we get into that.
Yeah.
Where it's just you're just flowing. You're moving from one idea to the next. You're making these connections. In the article, she's actually playing a game, but it's not just any video game. She is playing a game that's used to train the U.S. Army snipers. These guys who really need to be able to shoot accurately, fast, and well, or they're dead. I believe it was a woman who wrote the article. She's doing her best to just stay on top of this thing and falling behind and not doing very well with the exercise, working in it in an augmented way. They stick a couple electrodes on her head, and they're sending a mild electrical current into her brain. It's actually kind of rerouting some signals out of the neocortex and letting some other parts of the brain take over. And she's suddenly in this experience of 20 minutes goes by. She doesn't even realize the passage of time. And she asks, oh, how did I do? How many did I get? And the rather puzzled person running the game looks at her and says, you got all of them. Right. So it's this, this amazing difference in performance that she's able to achieve just by shooting an electrical current into her head. And they actually link here to people who are like self-hackers, biohackers, people who are experimenting with this themselves. Now, I would love to be able to achieve this, but I'm not sure, Stephen, that I'm actually ready to, like, put electrodes on my head and stick a 9-volt battery on them and see what happens.
You don't want to be part of the bleeding edge on that deal, do you? Well,
I almost do, but not quite. I think we'll find out
what the side effects are of this, and find out, you know. Let's try version 2.0, you know, when it comes out. Anyway,
or even 1.0, right? Yeah, you know, I mean, I don't think they're even there.
Yeah, you don't want to beta test this thing, do you?
This is somewhere in the alpha or beta stage, for sure, yeah.
Well, you know, there's almost a very similar thing that they were using the functional magnetic resonance imaging, functional MRI. What they were doing, Phil, in a very similar kind of deal, was they were taking various mystics or people that are, you know, known for a strong prayer life or whatever, and putting the electrodes on them and watching their brain as they enter a real deep part of their prayer life where they're communing with God. And then they get a picture of what's going on in the brain at that point. And they were actually taking that and able to, they would put it on the head of an atheist, you know, and click it on. And, it's like a life-changing kind of situation. I don't know how many atheists would sign on for that. It's
interesting.
Apparently, there are lots of mental states that, we can learn to turn on and off. And, again, I'm kind of with you, Phil. I don't necessarily want to beta test these things, but when they're generally available and we know that they're safe, there's when it comes down to do mathematics, I'm sure there's something you can kind of pump up and do better. When it comes down to any activity, I imagine there are things that can be done to optimize your brain for different activities.
I would think most people would benefit from having something like this, some version of this for their work, for the work that they do. Whatever their work is, you would think that
you enter a social situation and bang, you are like the life of the party because you've tweaked yourself in some way. Who knows how this could be used, but it's I imagine we're just scratching the surface here.
Well, and I'm glad you mentioned that about the spiritual experiences, because it just goes to show there is so much potential experience and so much potential use we can make of our brains that we're only beginning to understand. So this really is not only the age of achievable and maximizable serendipity, but I think we're closing in on the age of achievable and maximizable savanthood. So we've got that to look forward to. Now, one thing before
gone,
we...
man.
What's that?
The time is gone, and we must have been in the zone because the hour just flew by.
I think we were in the zone. Before we introduce the music, I just want to say, no, I did not hear the news of the Titanic on the radio, James. So, thank you very much for that thought. What's our song,
Phil, did not hear the the music tonight is Don't Be Harsh in My Mellow. So, you know, don't be parsing Phil's mellow by calling him old.
That's right. We're right here in the flow, and then I get that in the chat room. I've always been the show. All right, don't be harsh in my mellow. Thanks. Thank you, Stephen. And thanks to everyone for listening. We'll be back again next week with another brand new show. Look forward to being with you all then. And until next time, live to see it.
One, two, one, two.
Wait.
One, two, one. One, two, one, two. If you like, you count it. Feel like I'm living a dream since I got it today. Packed up my troubles and I put them away. Got a bounce in my step and I'm feeling free. So if you're coming around to bring me down, you better let me be. Don't be harsh in my mellow. pushing my buttons. Don't string me along. Don't be jamming my brakes. I'm an easygoing fellow. We all make mistakes. Don't be harshing my mellow. When I say my prayers, I thank God I'm alive. And for family and friends I have in my life. Got a smile on my face. There's not a cloud in the sky. So if you come in bad news or singing the blues, you better pass me by. Don't be harsh in my mellow. Don't be putting me on. Don't be pushing my buttons. Don't string me along. Don't be jamming my brakes. I'm an easygoing fellow. We all make mistakes. Don't be harsh in my mellow. I look at my woman. She gives me a grin. She says she is liking that mood that I'm in. You see, it's contagious. So let the good times roll. So if you feel impressed or you're getting stressed, maybe it's time to let go. Don't be harsh in my mellow. Don't be putting me on. Don't be pushing my buttons. Don't string me along. Don't be jamming my brakes. I'm an easygoing fellow. We all make mistakes. Don't be harsh in my mellow. Don't be harsh in my mellow. Don't be putting me on. Don't be pushing my buttons. Don't string me along. Don't be jamming my brakes. I'm an easygoing fellow. We all make mistakes. But don't be harsh in my mellow. Don't be harsh in my mellow. Don't be putting me on. Don't be pushing my buttons. Don't string me along.